Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And we will get to our reporter roundtable a little bit later this hour. But we start this week with a one-on-one conversation with Dr. Amy Acton, who is running for governor as a Democrat. Acton says she's running for governor because she believes current politicians and special interests are moving Ohio backwards. Dr. Acton says she is not a politician, but a doctor, an advocate, and a problem solver. She became best known during the COVID-19 pandemic when she served as the head of Ohio's Department of Health. Dr. Acton, welcome to All Sides.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Amy.
So Republicans have such a stronghold on state government here. They hold all offices except one seat on the Ohio Supreme Court held by Jennifer Bruner. I mean, given these odds, why are you running for governor?
Well, I'm running for governor because people in Ohio are struggling and special interests, bad actors in our state house keep taking us in the wrong direction. I refuse to look the other way at this. It's been an honor of a lifetime to serve Ohioans, and everywhere I go in the state, we're seeing record crowds of people showing up. They are longing for public servants who actually solve problems instead of making problems, the problems of their everyday life.
Now, how did you learn that U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, plans to run for Senate again? Because there were rumors he was going to run for governor. Did he call you and give you a heads up?
Yes, I did. And I've been very close with the senator and Connie, his wife. They now live 4 blocks away from me, actually, in Bexley here.
So did you just see him when you were walking your dog? And you
I hope to take walks with the senator. But I'm so thrilled by his decision, by this news. I believe so strongly that Ohioans, again, are longing for change. And it's so important, I think, that we all take a stand. You know, in the state house, I don't know that a lot of people understand that our state house no longer is solving the everyday issues. And these are not Democratic or Republican issues that I hear when I'm out there. I'm seeing record crowds of folks that don't know parties showing up. They want us to talk about the issues they face in their day-to-day life. This last budget solved the problems of special interests. It was giving tax breaks to people who, quite frankly, weren't even asking for them. Meanwhile, they weren't solving the issues of our public schools, our health care, our energy costs. This is what Ohioans are talking about.
So having the fields like sort of cleared for you, knowing that former Senator Brown is not running for governor, does that make your campaign a little easier at this exact moment in time?
Well, you know, we have been so super focused. We've been going everywhere in this state and listening deeply to the people. You know, that's something we heard after the last election, that people feel that we really aren't hearing them. In my career, you know, I'm a doctor. I'm not a politician, but I have been a lifelong public servant. And everything I do when I solve problems, just like you saw me do very on air in COVID, but certainly before, when the governor and I solved things like the opiate crisis, I believe in putting the hard cards on the table, empowering people and empowering communities. When you face the things we face, like housing and childcare and aging in place, you know, if these problems were easy to solve, we'd have solved them already. You have to put the hard cards there, tell people the truth, get people around a table to have the hard conversations. And that's how we begin to move this state forward.
Now, other Democratic names have been tossed around. Tim Ryan, for example, former Congressman Tim Ryan. Do you know if he's still mulling over a race for governor?
You know, I really can't afford to spend my time or energy thinking about hypotheticals. I'm running for governor because I refuse to look the other way. While we aren't meeting the needs of everyday Ohioans, I can't say enough. I used to joke that I was like the Ted Lasso of politics when I first walked in the state house. We all pay a lot of attention to federal. We often know a lot about our local. But if we do not fix the state house, Ohio is going to continue to go backwards on nearly every measure.
Do you think if Tim Ryan is thinking about getting in the race, could you be his lieutenant governor or could he be your lieutenant governor?
I'm in this race for everything. We know we're very competitive. We see a very clear path to victory. And I'm running this race to be governor.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and this is All Sides. We're talking with Dr. Amy Acton, who is running for governor in Ohio as a Democrat. Let's jump to some recent news from over the weekend. Governor DeWine sent 150 Ohio National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. at the request of the Trump administration. Would you do something like that if the president asked you to as governor?
First of all, just by way of background, I have the deepest reverence for our National Guard, the men and women in this state who serve. I've had the good fortune of working alongside them, doing health clinics around the state with the National Guard, and also, as you know very well, the governor and I deploying them and using them deeply during one of the hardest crises our state has faced. I think you have to make these decisions with the utmost understanding of what their role is. Certainly, we all care about safety in our cities. This is not a situation, at least the information I have at this time. I know there are Republican governors who are not making this decision. I would be very laser focused on our towns. One of the things I'm most concerned by is the use of fear mongering to pit us against one another. My opponent is doing this. I think it's so important that a governor work closely with our mayors. Our governor does, in fact, work closely with our mayors, and I intend to continue doing that work to ensure that our cities are safe. But what I worry about, and especially in my opponent and in this legislature, is they keep doing the same old policies of giving special interests to the wealthiest while they are actually defunding the police. Now, they are not funding our local fund, and my opponent continues this same belief system, which is actually why our police do not have all the resources they need. We are not doing some of the prevention we can be doing. My opponent recklessly says that he would get rid of all property taxes, and that actually means, in a sense, not helping our police, our firefighters, our EMS, our first responders. I think it's very important that we are very responsible, and a governor, this is a huge responsibility.
Well, to back up for a second, though, do you disagree with Governor DeWine sending the troops?
You know, I do not yet see that this is the appropriate deploying of policing in another city. But again, I always defer to the fact that a governor is often seeing things that we are all not seeing. So I won't judge his decision. But I can tell you that as governor, I would take this very seriously. And I do have concerns about this being used more as a fear-mongering and sort of a political a stunt than actually the real need for our people.
Your campaign has been described a few times as rather quiet over the past few months. I'm sure you don't feel it's quiet. I'm sure you feel very busy, but perhaps maybe a little under the radar. I know you've been traveling the state, but what's your strategy as we pick up and head into the fall here, which is traditionally the kickoff of political campaigns? You stepped in a little early.
Well, you know, it's been an honor and a privilege to be traveling the state. I would add not in a personal jet or an airplane of my own, but actually in my old Jeep. We have put so many miles on this Jeep that my husband keeps saying he's doing the oil change again. So we have literally, and to tell the truth, I've been on the road for years now, certainly last year, listening deeply. We raised a record amount in our first two quarters. We're very proud of that. And what's most important, we are spending our time listening, and we raised a record amount of donors giving to this. And the average gift that came from 88 counties was $24. So we have been spending a lot of time with the people, and we are now growing our campaign quite rapidly. I'm very excited. I think people will hear more from us as we grow. We hired our first digital social director. She started 2 weeks ago. Her first day At work, we were actually kicked off the X platform. So we begin with a bang, and we're certainly getting our message out there a lot more. I believe so deeply in going directly to the people.
You've raised, as you said, a little more than $1 million, which is a record for a Democratic candidate for governor at this point in the race. But that's a fraction of the 9.7 million a Republican opponent has, Vivek Ramaswamy. He does have billionaire campaign coffers. But how are you going to match that throughout the campaign? 1 million versus 9 million. It's a big jump.
Yes. Well, I have great confidence that we're going to raise the money we need to get our message out in this campaign. We know that Sherrod Brown was making a decision, so that certainly was in the air. You know, a lot of folks are concerned about a primary, but we did set a record for Democratic candidates. And we hired our first financial director. She comes to us from the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, the Susan Crawford race, if you remember, where Elon was trying to buy that race. I know that we're up against a self-funding billionaire and people like Yass, who just gave $10 million to his PAC because he wants to do away with public schools, something I will be fighting for. Public schools saved my life. My husband is an elementary public school teacher for 43 years. It is sad that since Citizens United, Sherrod Brown's last race, the Senate race between the two candidates, $500 million was spent. So we're absolutely certain that we can raise, we will be in the same kind of fight in this governor's race. When Mike DeWine first ran, I remember him saying the cost that he was told originally was $4 million. And I know my race starts at $40 million. And we may get upwards in this total across both candidates of $250 million. That's a shame what we could be doing with this money. But we do have quite ability to raise money, and we'll go toe-to-toe. But in the end, we are creating a grassroots movement of the people. It is essential we know that billionaire special interests are taking over this country. And the only time you beat back billionaires and any kind of bullying that we see happening, whether it was the 1930s or the 1870s, is when the people unite, put arms together, and they push back. And I absolutely believe what we are building, our platform, which is rolling out this summer, is an Obama-like platform. This is a movement of the people, and everywhere we go, we see record amounts. The team keeps telling me, you don't see this kind of crowd at the end of an election that we are seeing at the beginning. Independents, Republicans showing up alongside Democrats. We're absolutely sure that we have a movement of people that are ready to push back. We are tired and we're ready for change.
Former Governor Ted Strickland, the state's last Democratic governor, talked to WOSU recently about what he said to you when you asked him for his endorsement. Now, his comments were made to WOSU before the news that Brown would not run for governor and is running for Senate. He praised you, but he said he was withholding the endorsement until he knew about Sherrod Brown and Tim Ryan. Let's listen.
Given the circumstances, there's no room for, you know, miscalculating. And just for reasons that have nothing to do with you or your skill or your abilities or your values, just because they've run statewide, either Tim or Sherrod would have a better shot at winning the governor's office than you. But you may be the better governor if you could get elected.
So what do you make of Ted Strickland holding back his support on you? I mean, he's saying you might be the better governor, but it feels like such a boys' club there with that comment.
Well, we know, sadly, now that you mentioned the Boys Club issue, that, you know, sadly, we've never elected a woman governor or senator in the state. I always tell crowds, Kansas, which isn't exactly a blue bastion, has had three women governors, one of them Kathleen Sebelius, John Gilligan's daughter. Michigan's about to get their third. I just had breakfast with Ted Strickland. I was honored by his comments saying, and this is so important, I hope our listeners understand this. I was so fortunate to work beside a governor well before COVID hit on some pretty tough issues. But certainly one of the most important things is a governor serves with 54,000 employees, endless boards and commissions, endless agencies. And one of the biggest things Ted and I talked about, and his team and I have talked about, was how important it is that you actually know how to do this job. The governor and I, since that time the governor was on air, we have released very deep dive polling. The governor is no longer concerned, as is Sherrod Brown, is going around telling folks that they absolutely now see that I can win and I have pathway forward. We are neck and neck with Vivek Ramaswamy, even with all those billions. We are neck and neck, and we absolutely have this grassroots movement. And what he saw, the governor saw, and what many are seeing now in the polling is that we have a pathway forward. We absolutely can win this. So I think in the weeks to come, you'll be hearing more of that.
Before we run out of time, more recently, you have been more vocal about your reasons for running for governor. I mean, there's the reason that you have on your webpage, and there's the reason that's on the flyers. But can you talk a little bit more about the deeper reason?
Thank you. Well, it's very important to know this theme that I have of refusing to look the other way, and certainly in the times we are living in, this is not a drill. I think we all have to use whatever voice or power we have. And I was blessed to have been given this voice in a very unique constituency from COVID that goes from the far right to the far left, everywhere in between, an incredibly high job approval rating, higher than any elected official on either side, very low negatives. But the real reason I refuse to look the other way is because of my childhood here in Ohio. I was raised in Ohio in Youngstown, really rough childhood, a lot of abuse, a lot of neglect, homeless. As many know, this is an issue near and dear to my heart. I lived in a tent in the winter as a kid, still going to school. I often say public schools and libraries saved my life as a kid. They were able to give me food and breakfast. When I spoke to superintendents recently, the biggest thing they want is free breakfast and lunch. I was one of those kids. They understand how vitally important these things are. And so I've lived the experience of not having a house and not having food and being hungry and many of the other issues that I want to fight for Ohioans on. I was blessed to be removed from that circumstance at the age of 12, but I was haunted by the kids left behind who are just as smart and just as nice as the kids at my new school, but I watched their lives go completely different way. I remember the people who looked away as a kid, but I mostly remember the people who didn't. I remember a couple who would pull my brother and I up on their porch on the north side of Youngstown, walking to school and feed us because they knew we were hungry. All of us in this state must refuse to look the other way. Ohio is not where it should be. It has some of the lowest health outcomes. They're attacking our public schools. This is one of the most unifying issues on both sides of the aisle. Everywhere I go, public schools are our way of life, and this budget did not fund the bipartisan funding proposal. These things that I am fighting for are so essential. They are the things I am hearing from Ohioans. 99% of what we talk about on both sides of the aisle are problems we all share. And that is what a governor and that is what the state legislature should be doing. We've been gerrymandered away from the good public servants on both sides of the aisle who want to solve problems instead of make them. And I am running for governor because I have been given this voice. I refuse to look the other way, and I will fight every day for Ohioans.
Well, Dr. Amy Acton, I want to thank you for your time today.
You.
We also sent requests to have the Republican candidate, Vivek Ramaswamy, on our show, and we provided dates in August and September, and we're told he was unavailable for the dates we sent, so we hope we can bring him on sometime in the future. We've been talking with Dr. Amy Acton, who is running for Ohio governor as a Democrat. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to catch up on the latest political news and resume our regular reporter roundtable. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With us today, we have Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hi, great to be here.
Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
And Noah Blundo, executive editor for Hanna News Service. Welcome back, Noah.
Good morning.
So we just heard from Dr. Amy Acton, who is running for governor as the Democratic candidate. So far, the only announced Democrat. And you all have been following Dr. Acton's campaign. Did you hear anything new or different this morning listening to her?
I think that might have been the first time I've heard her criticize Mike DeWine. You know, it struck me that she took a step back when you asked her about the decision to send National Guard troops to D.C. First, she kind of talked about fear-mongering from Republicans, and then she said that she's not in Governor DeWine's chair and doesn't know how to, you know, what he's seeing and that kind of stuff. But then she kind of brought it back, saying, you know, I forget exactly what the sequence was, but that struck me. I've noticed that before. It wouldn't surprise me if what we see is her almost running to continue what Mike DeWine did. I mean, he did win by 30 points. She was part of the administration. It wouldn't make sense for her to try to distance herself from, you know, the guy when the two of them worked together on the project that I think most Ohioans kind of know the governor for. So that's something that struck me. It wasn't exactly new, but it's sort of a new continuation of something I've kind of seen in the past.
And Jeremy, what do you make of her talking about these endorsements? Because I asked her about how Ted Strickland hasn't endorsed her yet. He was kind of waiting on Brown. Was it just, it seemed like everything was waiting on Sherrod Brown.
I mean, the context of this is that Democrats across the state have been waiting on Sherrod Brown to decide what his plans were before everyone makes endorsements and the rest of the party slate lines up. So now that Sherrod Brown has decided to run for U.S. Senate, and he announced this morning that he is, the slate is starting to fall into place. However, the other context is that Amy Acton might not be running alone. You might have Tim Ryan, former congressman and 2022 U.S. Senate candidate, jumping in the race. People are waiting to see what he decides. But I think you're going to see a lot more coalescing now of sides now that Sherrod Brown has jumped in the race. So a while back, people were on the fence, and but now I think you're going to see people land one way or the other.
And Noah, you know, a Democrat running in red Ohio is an uphill challenge for sure for anyone. Amy Acton seemed very optimistic. She's building support county by county, but she's not a seasoned politician. Can a non-politician win in such a red Ohio?
I mean, that's the major question, and I would not dare to predict what the political environment will be when early voting begins in, you know, 14 months from now or something like that. I mean, one thing to think about is that these races, this race and all races, have just become so much more nationalized. So, you know, certainly Amy Acton, the kind of campaign she runs, the kind of money she raises is going to matter. But it's also going to matter what people think about President Trump and how they feel about the economy. You know, those will be big factors that could put her over the top if there's a sufficient blue wave, or could sink her if, you know, it's kind of middling.
Andrew?
And yeah, I mean, when this kind of topic comes up, I always think about the fact that Kansas has a Democratic governor who's elected in 2018. Obviously, that was a really good year for Democrats nationally. There were some local issues there about tax reforms and what that did to the state government. Tax cuts, just to be clear. And Andy Beshear was elected governor of Kentucky in 2019. Both he and Laura Kelly, the governor of Kansas, were subsequently reelected, even though there's this heavily nationalized environment where, you know, it's unusual to see Republican states voting for Democratic candidates and not just thinking they're all the same, you know, in today's political environment. But it is those examples show us that it is possible. So a lot of things would have to kind of line up. But certainly we see that it's, you know, we have examples before us of things like that happening.
Well, and an example here in Ohio, Nan Whaley ran for governor. She was from Dayton, and she only won three counties, Franklin, Cuyahoga, and Athens. Did Nan Whaley, Jeremy, help pave the way for the idea of a woman running for governor here in the state?
I think whenever you have a female candidate at the top of the ticket, it makes it more normalized and mainstream. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot, to your previous question, we are 15 months away from the election, and anyone who says that they know exactly how this is going to end is either deluding themselves or they're lying. There's a lot that can happen. And for these candidates, even at the top of the ticket for U.S. Senate or governor, so much of this is dictated by national politics that's kind of outside their control. Things like, what is Donald Trump's approval rating? What's going on in the country? And Amy Acton's job now will be to have to, well, first, she has to survive a primary or a potential primary. And then if she can do that, try to separate Vivek Ramaswamy and just kind of poke holes in his candidacy. And one good thing for her and other Democrats is that Donald Trump's not on the ballot. On the other hand, you know, look what happened to Nan Whaley. And I think that a number of Democrats, you know, Acton's one of a handful of Democrats to jump in the race so far. And in addition to the Sherrod Brown issue, a lot of Democrats are just hesitant to risk their political career running in a state that is almost entirely dominated by Republicans. And the last time someone ran for statewide office for a governor, she had her butt handed to her. So we'll see how it goes.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, Andrew. A good illustration of that is that I think we have six Republicans running to challenge Jennifer Bruner, the Democratic Supreme Court justice. We have, I don't think we have six Democratic candidates running on the statewide slate, period.
For anything. Yeah.
And so just like things like that kind of illustrate how the political landscape looks like here.
Well, let's talk about the political landscape where Ohio fits nationally for a minute. Jeremy, Sherrod Brown officially confirmed his run for U.S. Senate this morning. The rumors had been around for a few days, so we already have some initial reaction since we were talking about it over the weekend. What's initial reaction been like?
It's been exactly what you might expect from people who have had a few days to prepare for this. Already Elizabeth Warren is sending out a fundraising email about it. I think Democrats are excited overall. If they're most excited outside of Ohio because it gives Democrats a little bit more hope that they have a chance to take back the Senate. That's going to be a real uphill battle for them because not only do they have to hold all of their existing seats, they also have to pick up at least four seats, which is a pretty tough slog, but at the same time, Sherrod Brown's entry in the race makes it a little less of a slog. So I think many Democrats are excited. However, I think many Ohio Democrats, especially in labor, were ready and very hopeful that Brown was going to run for governor. And in their mind, that Brown is the top candidate for any office in Ohio who's a Democrat. And they were very unpleasantly surprised when he decided to run for Senate.
So, yeah, you wrote about how labor leaders were laying the groundwork for Brown to be governor. Aren't both seats important is what I'm trying to say? But for labor leaders, they care more about the governorship?
Well, you can only have one Sherrod Brown. You can't clone him. And so there were people urging Sherrod to run for Senate. So people saying, you know, help me, Sherrod, you're my only hope.
Oh.
And then people are asking him to run for governor saying, help me, Sherrod, you're my only hope. And he had to make a decision.
Andrew, do you think he was the only hope?
I think it also has to do with kind of what's their immediate concern. And so two of the major unions in Ohio that particularly are affiliated with Democrats are AFSCME, which I'm not going to try to rattle off the acronym off the top of my head, but it's basically government employees, including school staff. And then the Ohio Education Association, which is the big teachers union. So I think there's real concern from those two sectors about what Vivek Ramaswamy might do to state government, whether it's, you know, drastically cutting spending, whether it's drastically cutting property taxes that fund schools, or even whether it's, you know, expanding funding of private schools. And, you know, Amy Acton mentioned Jeff Yass, a big contributor to Vivek's campaign, who is a big proponent of privatizing schools. So I think it kind of more reflects, in addition to what Jeremy said, the very specific kind of missions that those organizations have.
Noah?
And who will be your boss of, you know, 50,000 state employees, the majority of whom are unionized.
So, Noah, just back to you for a second. Has Senator John Husted and his team responded to this news about Brown running for the seat? Have we heard from Husted?
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember what, but they were. I mean, last week I think when the news sort of unofficially broke, they were ready to say, ready with the attack, and they were back this morning. You know, they put out a statement saying, you know, the Ohioans face a clear choice, and that Brown has imposed Washington's problems on Ohio with radical liberal policies, and that, you know. John Hughes said, we'll apply Ohio's values and solutions to fix Washington. I mean, you know, they've had months to prepare. I'm sure they've got many more salvos to launch.
Yeah, they probably wrote that statement years ago.
They haven't even been there for years. How long has he been senator? Like, what's the timeline here?
2006. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Houston.
Houston. Technically early February.
Oh, but it's just all the same statement. They just pass it around.
I see.
Shortly.
Okay.
Just a Mad Lib. Insert Democratic candidate here.
Got it.
It used to be say it would be the Mad Lib statement, but now you say it's the ChatGPT statement.
Certainly. So Politico had an interesting story about how crypto money helped defeat Sherrod Brown in the last election, spending more than $40 million, and how a super PAC could leverage more this time around. Andrew, Brown has been a crypto critic in the past. So what do you think he's going to have to lean into this since it was big in defeating him last time?
I mean, ultimately, the money that was spent last year, it was basically break even. I think the crypto money moved it into Bernie Moreno, the Republican candidate and now senator's direction. But we're talking about $500 million. So $40 million, while, you know, far be it from me, a journalist, to kind of turn my nose up at that kind of quantity of money. I don't think it was like the deal breaker. So, but what I mean, people might look at it that way. But I think there's going to be so much money in this race that something like that, you know, it would not surprise me to see, frankly, John Husted lean into that to try to emphasize that contrast and possibly have campaign benefits that emanate from it. But, you know, I don't think Brown's going to be reluctant to share his views on that by any means. I just think it's part of the landscape now that's cooked in.
There's only so many 30-second spots during an Ohio State football game, and once you're in excess of $500 million, it doesn't, you know, you can't create more time for the
ads. You can just buy them all.
Yeah.
Got it. And then lastly, before we move on from governor-senator, which these are bleeding together right now, Jim Tressel, our current lieutenant governor, he could alter this governor race landscape. He has previously said he's considering a run. What's the expectation that he could take any momentum away from Ramaswamy?
The expectation is he is not going to run for governor. Mm-hmm. He has not built up a campaign staff, and he's left the door open when pressured and asked about it, but he's shown no sign that he is doing the things someone needs to do to run a campaign, calling Republicans to either ask for money or to line up support, get a staff together. He hasn't really done any of that.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com and from Signal Ohio, Andrew Tobias, and from Hannah News Service, Noah Blundo. So over the weekend, Governor DeWine sent 150 National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. at the request of the Trump administration. This is presumably to help with the administration's takeover of the Metropolitan Police Department in D.C. And Ohio was not the only state to get this request and comply. Andrew, why do you think Governor DeWine said yes?
We've basically seen him agree to do things like this in the past. I mean, the example that comes most clearly to me was when the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, sent troops to the southern border. DeWine chipped into that. But there have been other things, too. I suppose that actually providing law enforcement in American City, basically, is what they're doing here. I mean, maybe he might view that qualitatively differently, but I don't see it as being that out of line with things that he's done in the past. But I haven't had a chance to ask him about it, so I don't know what he's thinking.
Right. And Jeremy, were you surprised by that news over the weekend that we participated with troops?
Not particularly, for the reasons that Andrew said, that the governor's done this in the past. This is more controversial than his previous, for example, he sent National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. for Biden's inauguration after the January 6th storming of the Capitol. I don't think he got a lot of grief for that, over that at all. But this is more heavily politicized, and it's more controversial for President Trump to send and basically try to militarize the Washington, D.C. police when there's no, when it's an otherwise ordinary time. And Governor DeWine has a history of not sticking his neck out when he doesn't have to, especially with President Trump. There's a lot of calls by journalists and by critics for him to speak out against Trump in the past, and he's not every time, but most times he declines the opportunity to do so if he can help it.
Go ahead, Noah.
Yeah, I was going to say, as Jeremy said, he does not relish conflict with the president, or really with presidential administrations. I mean, he's talked about how the reality of the day is you need to have a relationship with Washington, D.C. because of all the overlap between federal and state policy.
And this announcement came about the troops on Saturday, and then a group pulled together a small protest on Sunday. There were about 50 people at the State House, which I guess is, I would consider small, but a lot to pull together in less than 24 hours. Do you think that we'll see more of that at the State House, Noah? Or are there always protests?
There are always protests. Yeah. I mean, over this particular issue, I'm not sure. There have been much larger protests in opposition to the Trump administration recently. I don't know that this particular issue is that salient, although we'll see how long the federal authorities are on the ground in D.C. and how that situation evolves.
Coming up, we're going to talk about property taxes and also why the Browns Stadium has hit a snag. And also, the Ohio Supreme Court race is getting awfully crowded. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides, and this is our weekly reporter roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with us, Andrew Tobias, state, government, and politics reporter for Signal Ohio, Noah Blundo, executive editor for Hannah News Service, and Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Noah, the governor's working group on property taxes met last week. Did they make any progress? Everyone loves a good working group.
I don't know that they're going to have an any easier time than the legislature did on this. I mean, property taxes are such a bedrock of local funding, and ultimately, the money has to come from somewhere. So, they're batting around some ideas, but how they'll fare. I mean, ultimately, they're going to make recommendations to the governor. But it's the legislature who has to do any of this, and they kind of have already made their opinion known about what they would like property tax policy to be.
All right, we'll leave it there because we talk about property taxes so much on this show, and man, they're a lot. Jeremy, I want to move on to another thing we talk about a lot on this show, plans for the Browns domed stadium, which will be funded at least in part by Ohioans using unclaimed funds to the tune of $600 million. It hit a snag with state aviation officials. Can you give us an update there?
Yeah, this kind of came out of the blue on last week when ODOT's aviation division, the actual letter was sent out August 1st, but it became public last week when ODOT's aviation division said, hey, we looked at your plans for the Brown Stadium, and it's right next to Cleveland Hopkins International Airport. And it's going to be an air traffic hazard if you build the stadium as high as you're planning to. The Browns had their plans for this new stadium called for sinking the field 80 feet into the ground to avoid such a hazard. But ODOT said, no, well, even so, this is going to be, the stadium will be too high, that'll be an airspace hazard. So if you, ODOT gave him basically two options, which is either make the stadium lower at its highest point or move the stadium farther away from the airport so planes wouldn't have a potential hazard. This came at the direction of Cleveland Hopkins officials. And the question now is, well, where did that come from? Where did these officials, why did they object? And it's no secret that local officials like Cleveland Mayor Justin Bibb, Cuyahoga County Executive Chris Ronayne, are no fans of moving the Browns out of Cleveland, out of their lakefront home, to the suburb of Brook Park, which is where the Browns want to build the stadium. So the question now is, where did these objections from airport officials came from?
Now, I'm not expecting you to be an aviation height expert here, because we just learned all of this, and I didn't even know ODOT had an aviation division until right this second. So, but when I think of something being in the way of a plane, I'm thinking of like a 30-story building. I mean, how tall is this football stadium?
So looking at it, they deal with heights in terms of sea level. And so I'm personally, maybe other people can talk about it. It doesn't just say exactly. The best I can find is the stadium at its tallest point is 221 feet above the ground. Now, where's the ground? You know, anyone who lives on a hill can tell you that the ground can vary. And so the best I could find is that it's about 221 feet above the ground. ODOT says that the stadium has to be reduced by 58 feet, at least 58 feet to comply. And ODOT says, well, when you lower it by 58 feet, give us a call. And I should note, too, that they denied a construction permit to build the stadium. And the Browns shot back with confusion, saying, well, we never applied for a permit. What permit? And it looks like ODOT preemptively did this because the Browns submitted paperwork with the FAA. And the FAA said, yeah, this is fine. Technically, you guys are higher than, I believe it's something about imaginary airspace, something, I forget exactly the term. But overall, you guys are fine. And then ODOT came back and said, no, you guys are not fine because Cleveland Hopkins is objecting to this.
Interesting. Okay, Andrew, what do you make of the Cleveland Browns Stadium having yet another saga here? I mean, should we be giving them $600 million in unclaimed funds if they can't get the height right?
You know, this whole thing has the feel of just being, you know, cooked in, and that we're just gonna get there. I mean, they got the funding from the legislature despite some of the kind of like questions I had about whether that was politically advisable, or, you know, there's internal opposition in the caucus, but they got it through. So, and the governor signed it into law. So I don't think this is him saying that he thinks suddenly this project shouldn't happen. And so he's having his transportation department try to sandbag it. But I don't know, like Jeremy said, I'm not an aviation expert. I'm not sure if this is outside of the norm, but I just think it's kind of funny. Like,
I do too. Noah, are you an aviation expert?
I am not. I'm just going off of Andrew's point, DeWine, after he signed the budget, was amenable to the idea. He said, well, I wanted something that would prevent us from coming around with these one-offs. Oh, I want $300 million. Oh, I want $500 or $600. And every budget cycle having these stadium owners with their tin cups in hand, he wanted an ongoing funding solution that didn't take state general revenue fund money. And that's what the legislature gave him, not his idea, which was increased gambling taxes. But he said, well, we met my objectives, so I was, you know, willing to sign it.
But the stadium is there. I mean, the flight path is just right around that area. I'm sure they're going to have to consider where the stadium is. So I don't think it's like a non-issue or anything like that. But interested to see if, do they just lower it by 60 feet or do they extract some concession from the team? There's also the ongoing lawsuit to try to block the unclaimed money from being used in this way. So I guess there's still legal hurdles this thing's faced, even though it's kind of gotten, to use like the football metaphor, gotten the ball pretty far down the field.
Well, Noah, Andrew just mentioned, you know, former Attorney General Mark Dan and State Representative Jeff Crossman they sued over using unclaimed funds for the Brown Stadium. They want the U.S. Supreme Court to get involved in this issue. Do you have an update there?
I know that they asked the court to you know weigh in on this case, but I'm not not sure there's been any other development beyond that.
To use the football metaphor, does this case cause the whole plan to fumble? can we give the unclaimed funds away while there's a pending case, I guess?
It's legal till it's not. Mm-hmm. And under the budget, the funds aren't going to be distributed till after January 1st. So it's not going to happen right away. Mm-hmm. We'll see what happens. Another wrinkle is that there is a U.S. Supreme Court, potential U.S. Supreme Court case from California that involves a similar question of whether the state can seize unclaimed funds in this way. And the same lawyers in this case are asking the Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court to accept that case. And so that could be an added wrinkle, too.
This is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, and Noah Blundo from Hanna News Service. Andrew, the Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose made a ruling last week that blocked two counties' attempts to ban voting machines. What prompted this ruling?
So there's been, ever since the 2020 election, there's been a movement. They call themselves election integrity activists, but there's a spectrum. It's hard to kind of generally characterize a loosely affiliated movement, but they think there might be voter fraud. They think that the state's elections laws are too loose, that there are vulnerabilities. And these people have basically been operating in the background of Republican politics ever since then, whether it's, you know, pressuring local officials to do certain things or whether it's lobbying for more restrictive elections laws in Columbus. But at some point, somebody found in the state law a provision that talks about when they actually authorized voting machines in the first place about 15 years ago, they passed a law that says that county commissioners can vote to have voting machines, boards of election can vote to do it. Or the third way is that citizens can collect enough signatures and force a countywide vote on whether or not to use voting machines. So somebody found that law and they thought, hey, that kind of sounds like we could ban voting machines. If we can vote to accept them, maybe we could also put this up for a vote, people vote no, and then that would revoke the right to have them. They were gathering signatures to that end. They were successful at meeting the signature criteria in Seneca and Monroe County, which are in like the Toledo area and kind of the Athens area, respectively. Frank LaRose caught wind of this. He issued a written advisory basically saying, this is meant to approve these. It's not meant to ban them. Mm-hmm. Like there is, you know, according to him, examples of language that is written with the intent to ban something. That's not what this is. That's what he said. So it kind of pulls the plug on that whole thing. I talked with activists in that movement, and they're going to kind of consider their options. But I thought it was an interesting illustration of just this kind of political factor that's operating in the background of state politics and kind of, you know, I think forcing Republicans to at least take things like this seriously.
So do they want to go back to paper voting? What do they want to do if there's no voting machines?
So, yeah, that is what they have in mind. We had a very, very long elections bill that some of the same people involved with this were backing and helped write. In that case, they wanted to their earlier point I just made, proactively allow for these kinds of votes. I guess they decided to try to kind of like, you know, bank shot it is what I call it. It's kind of like hitting off of something else and trying to achieve the same goal. But in that legislation, they also imagined basically setting up a hand-counted paper ballot, which we've seen in other states where that's occurred, elections dragging on for days and days to actually count them. You know, I interviewed Frank LaRose, who said that hand-counting ballots is actually less accurate, that people make mistakes when they count things, which I've never tried to count an election, which I don't know that I wouldn't want to put myself in charge of that, but I try to count things all the time and I kind of get off one or two. So I'm actually pretty sympathetic to that idea. But yeah, that's what they want. And I don't know how likely it is that they'll ever accomplish that, but you really do have to take things like this seriously. We've seen in states like Nevada, this kind of thing kind of gets some legs. So it was just interesting to see it pop up here.
All right. We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to talk about the Supreme Court race that is so crowded. Six Republicans and one Democrat are on the court, and a Republican justice is challenging his Democratic colleague, Jennifer Bruner. Jeremy, catch us up on how many people are in this race.
It's a lot, and it's sort of a feeding frenzy for the last Democratic-held statewide seat, as Andrew said earlier. What happened? The big thing in this race will be if the Republican Party, the state Republican Party, endorses in the race. There was a screening committee on Saturday, as Andrew broke. They gave the recommendation for an endorsement to Ron Lewis, who is a state appeals court judge from Xenia. That was interesting, considering that one of the candidates in the race is a sitting Supreme Court Justice, Pat Fisher, who is seeking to run for a different seat, even though his current tenure on the court doesn't expire till 2028. We'll see if the state Republican Party ends up endorsing, and it's kind of a free-for-all right now.
All right. Well, we'll catch up more on that the next time. Thank you to Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter at Signal Ohio.
Always happy to do it.
And thank you, Noah Blundo, executive editor for Hannah News Service. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And if you missed the beginning of the hour, I spent time talking with Dr. Amy Acton. You can find that interview at WOSU.org.